All right, well, thank you, ladies, for having me this morning. Let me say a quick prayer, and then we will jump into our topic for today. Father, thank you so much for these ladies and their journey, specifically as moms, today as we really discuss what it means to love our children well. Father, I pray as they engage with their kids each and every day, recognizing, Lord, that your word gives us so much information, and yet oftentimes in the daily application, it can be a little bit more challenging than that. And so, Lord, we ask for your blessing, and we thank you. We pray in your name. Amen. All right. Well, the first thing I'm going to do is get rid of this big podium because it's really, I feel like I have a wall between me and you.
Sorry, I'm not
going to
move it.
No. It's all good. It's all good. It's on wheels, I think, so. My coffee will stay there, and the notes will go here. Ah, that's better. All right. So we have, there's three segments to the discussion today. The first one is, if you're taking notes, the first one is, what's love got to do with it? We're going to answer the question, what does that mean? Then we're going to talk about pitfalls of parental love. So what's love got to do with it? Pitfalls of parental love. And then we're going to take a really fast kind of journey through the five love languages. Okay, because we all know what they are. I'm certain you know what they are. Maybe you and your husband went through a five love languages class when it comes to marriage or whatever. But we're going to kind of drill down into some of that when it comes to what it means to with our relationship with our kids. So it was the summer of 1984. I just graduated from college. I had a summer job, and I was preparing to head off to seminary, and it was the summer that Tina Turner's song, What's Love Got to Do With It, came out. Now, some of you might not have been born then. Most of you might not have been born then. Okay. But the song goes like this. It says, what's love got to do with it? What's love but a secondhand emotion? What's love got to do with it? Who needs a heart when a heart can be broken? And it's clear that, you know, our friend Tina Turner was struggling through the relationship of pain, and her goal really seemed to kind of distance from the reality of the need for love. But the truth is that we were all designed for love. So in answering the question, what's love got to do with it, it's that we were designed for this. And I don't think that any of us in this room as followers of Christ would resist the notion that we were designed for relationship, we're designed for intimacy, we're designed for love. It's the way God created us. You know, Genesis 1, 26 and 27 says, then God says, let us make man in our image, in our likeness. So he created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female, he created them. And this is the foundation of relationship, and you understand that. The challenge, though, is that shortly hereafter, this is Genesis chapter 1, and Genesis chapter 3, we have that whole icky thing called the fall, right, where Adam and Eve sinned, and then into this equation of relationship, which we're foundationally designed for, comes pain. God created us in his image, which means we are relational, we are volitional, we are emotional, we are spiritual, all these different things that are reflective of God, we have in us, in a broken way, but still present in a critical way. You all know Psalm 139, which says, for you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know them full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place. When I was woven together in the depths of the earth, your eyes saw my unformed substance. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. And this is the image of God, just the way he sees into our lives, the way he loves us and cares for us. And that shows itself in our lives. We were designed for this. Because we were designed for it then, under what's love got to do with it, we clearly then have a need for it, right? So slightly different. The design reveals itself in the reality that we have a need. I have a bunch of friends, many of you, some of you may have gone through the process of adoption. You certainly know others who have. And sometimes that's a challenge and a struggle. I've known many who have struggled through the realities of the attachment challenges related to adoption because of early disconnectedness that didn't manifest itself in full-blown connectedness. Because we were designed for love, we need it. And when we don't get it effectively, especially in those early years, it can be a challenge. Children with a full love tank learn how to effectively differentiate, take risks, and respond to parental structure with receptivity. So a child that is loved well, has a full love tank, knows how to take risks, differentiate, and is receptive to structure around them. An empty love tank, they will experience a sense of deprivation, shame, and a host of other challenges. Children without a full love tank will struggle to successfully differentiate, take risks, and live under structure in the world around them as children and as adults. Loved well, let me say it this way, loved well, a child cannot be too loved. A spoiled child isn't an overly loved child. A spoiled child is a child who is loved poorly. Write that down. All right? A child who is spoiled is not an overly loved child. It is a child who is loved poorly. Loved well, a child cannot be too loved. Today's world is filled with children who are basically told that the world revolves around them. These children in our world around us who are shown in some measure that the world revolves around them, who are overly showered with things, bailed out of consequences for poor performance, not held accountable to what they ought to do in life, and yet they feel badly about themselves every single time. I have a friend who was struggling with their teenager. Their teenager was getting into a variety of different elements of trouble, primarily with some dabbling in drugs and so forth. And one afternoon, my friend got a phone call that the police had pulled over their son who had a car full of other kids. And upon investigation, there wasn't anything to really hold the kids over. So he's like, do you want me to kind of release these boys? And he's like, absolutely not. You wait until I get there. One of the other dads of one of the other boys that was in the car, when he got there, before even understanding why they were pulled over, what the concern was, he started laying into this police officer to defend a child that he had no idea what had even occurred. This is becoming more and more commonplace. Lon Solomon, my former senior pastor at McLean Bible Church, tells a story of one of his sons, who are all grown now, when he was a teenager in the youth group, got a call from the teacher, one of the leaders, and about behavior. And so he comes home, he's like, Dad, they're kind of getting into it at home, and he says, Dad, are you going to believe a total stranger over your own son? And he said, every time. Every time. Because that was a day 20 years ago when adults trusted one another to intervene with one another. If you saw my kid acting out, you would have felt comfortable intervening and setting structure in my absence, because this is what adults did. Not today. That's a very dangerous thing to do today. Very dangerous thing to do today. Because we have a generation of children that believe that the world revolves around them and that the parents are the ones that are teaching them that, to the point of bailing them out when they shouldn't. So what's love got to do with it? Everything. We were designed for it, therefore we need it. And when loved well, a child cannot be too loved. Second thing for today is we are going to cover the pitfalls of parental love. Because we are broken, fallen people. And we don't always love well. We don't always love well. So the first thing in understanding the pitfalls of parental love is knowing yourself. In order to love your children well, you need to know about you. One of the questions that I would have for you in understanding yourself as a lover of your children is asking you the question, how well loved were you? How well loved were you? If you were loved well as a girl growing up into womanhood, then you will likely love well. If you grew up reasonably well adjusted because you were loved, you effectively differentiated, you know where others end and you begin, you know what boundaries are all about, you will love well. Before I became a pastor, I think most of you probably know this from some message that I gave somewhere where I included this, I worked in psychiatric hospitals for about a decade. So I graduated from seminary with a master's of divinity and then a master's in counseling as well. And I went directly into working in inpatient psychiatric facilities. One of the most challenging family dynamics is when you have a single mother and a teenage boy, and it's the only two of them in the home. So I got this teenage boy. I'm working with him in the hospital, and we're going to have a family meeting, so mom's going to show up. And I walk into the room, and there's mom in the room, and there's son in the room, and I go, okay, it makes a lot of sense now, working with my teenage client. And more often than not, in that dynamic, what I've seen is a woman who wasn't loved well growing up. Whatever happened with the father, that obviously blew apart. And now she's in relationship with a teenage boy who's becoming a man. And I discover that they're relating more like peers and almost a dating relationship than anything else, which is damaging for her and enormously damaging for him. Because she wasn't loved well. Now, as an adult woman, without the capacity to self-reflect, she doesn't understand how poorly she's loving him because they're of her own unmet needs all along the way. Do you need to have had a perfect childhood to be a mom who loves well? No, none of us had that. The question isn't just how well you were loved. The question is understanding the gaps and the deficiencies in how well you were loved and understanding what you need to do for you so that then you can turn around and love your children well. Let me say it this way. We all tend to love in the way we want to be loved. So we're going to get to the five love languages in just a few minutes. But if your child has a different love language than you do, you are going to love your child the way you want to be loved, and you are going to miss the mark. You're going to do all these things, whatever it happens to be, for your child, and they're going to walk away internally going, I feel unloved. And you're going to go, what? Well, all that I do for you, all that in one category or another, and all the while you don't realize that you are missing the mark because you haven't self-reflected enough about what love means for you. If you've been through this material in a marital context, you will likely understand this in some measure related to your spouse, because you'll do the same thing there. My wife's love language is, primary love language is quality time. My primary love language is acts of service. So I love to do stuff for her, and she wants me to spend time with her. So I do all these wonderful things for her, and yet she feels unloved. She's like, can you just do one less thing for me and just spend time with me? I'm like, oh, all right, I think we can do that. See how that works? Same thing with your kids. The second pitfall in loving your children well is understanding the reality that none of your children are the same. I have two children. That was plenty for us, okay? Some of you have taken greater risks in life and now are managing a lot more than that. And my two children could not be more different from each other. Could not be more different from each other. And how I love them according to what they prefer in the way they would want to be loved makes all the difference in the world. My son is 14 years old. He's 6'2", wears a 15 shoe that he's continuing to grow into, right? So our family pictures look ridiculous, right? So it's like, okay, you know, Who's the short guy? Oh, that's my dad. Okay. And Adam, he kind of perceives himself to be a lap dog, right? Like he's a physical touch kid. Physical touch is his primary love language. And he just wants to hang on you all the time. You know, it's the number of hugs that he requires each day versus the number of hugs that my wife or my daughter require each day. It's just no comparison. It's absolutely no comparison. It's humorous because God did not give him the body that was most appropriate for his love language. You know, it's just, I don't know how that worked out. But anyway. Okay, the third pitfall in understanding parental loving when it comes to our children is that we often assume that they know. We assume that they know. And we can't assume that they know. First John 3 says, "Dear children, do not love with words or speech, but with actions and in truth." And what this means is really engaged. It's not let your life and your words match up. Let everything come together. And what you'll see through all of this is that you need to be a good communicator of all five of the love languages, not just the one that seems to be most prominent. So all of these, to create well-rounded human beings around us, everybody, all of us need to be loved globally in all these ways with kind of a primary, kind of a first among equals, if you will. All right, so we've talked about what's love got to do with it, that we were designed for this, that therefore we need it. And then there are a variety of pitfalls that we need to understand in order to be effective in caring for the children that God has entrusted to us. And a lot of it has to do with personal self-evaluation in the journey. All right, so for the rest of our time, I really want to take a journey through the five love languages. Now, again, I trust that most of you probably know what they are. But as I studied it, I've studied it several times. I've spoken on this several times. It's like there's so many subtle pieces of this that can be challenging to ultimately get our arms around. They're like, oh, yeah, I hadn't thought about it quite like that. The first of the five love languages that I want to address is physical touch. Physical touch. Truly, the first engagement in all human relationship is physical touch. Bonding with your baby, often through nursing, but that skin-to-skin touch is the most grounding, critical element of our lives. We all start out with kind of the physical touch as our first primary love language, and then we kind of develop from there. There's an interesting passage in Luke chapter 5. It says, while Jesus was in one of the towns, it's Luke 5, 12 and 13. It says, while Jesus was in one of the towns, a man came along who was covered with leprosy. When he saw Jesus, he fell with his face to the ground and begged him, "Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean." Jesus reached out and touched the man. "I am willing," he said, "be clean." And immediately the leprosy left him. Now, it's very interesting. In a subsequent passage, I just read another passage in Luke this morning in my own personal time, and Jesus was on his way into Capernaum. There was a centurion there who had a servant that was dying. He sent messengers to Jesus saying, "Hey, my servant is dying. Will you please, 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 will you heal him?" Jesus started coming on his way to meet the man, and he sent another messenger saying, "Please, I'm not worthy for you to come under my house. I don't need you to show up. I'm a man under authority. I get it. You just say the word and it's done. I don't even need you to even see the man." He understood all. He said, "I'm a man under authority. I get it." And Jesus said, "I have never seen such faith in Israel." This Roman centurion. So in one situation, Jesus spoke a word without seeing a human being and healed the man from a distance, never laid eyes on the man. In this passage, the man said, "Please, please, can you heal me if you're willing?" What did Jesus do? He touched him. Why did he do that? In the world of the first century, you know this, you've watched the movie Ben-Hur, you know how this goes, right? Charlton Heston, his mother and his sister, you know, they're in a leper colony, and what happens with lepers? They are excluded and they are never touched. How long did this man have leprosy? We have no idea. But the one thing that was lacking in his life, if anything, if nothing else, he hasn't been touched by another human being in possibly years. Can you imagine not being touched ever? For some of us, physical touch is absolutely critical when it comes to the equation of love. Most parents, honestly, and if you have a bunch of kids, this is a challenge for you, but most parents ultimately end up in a place where they touch their children when they have to. When their children are asking for that, when they need something, when they need to be picked up, so forth, we tend to, especially in a world of being overwhelmed, we tend to only touch when we are required to do so. And I want to challenge you, always touch your kids, for no reason at all. But for those who have the love language of physical touch, it's absolutely paramount. And you understand that physical touch, you may have a boy, and as your boy gets older, physical touch from an affection standpoint morphs into other kinds of... You understand that males are very, very physical with each other. You understand that, right? It, from wrestling to other kinds of sports, it's okay. Now, this just stays here, right? This is just between us, all right? That, it's okay to touch another man's backside if you say good game, right? It is okay. Right? There are mechanisms for men to stay engaged physically, even with other men, that are legal if they have the appropriate structures in place. You with me? Like, physical touch is really important for all of us. For all of us. It may morph over the course of time, depending on the gender of your child. Navigating physical touch, especially as your kids get older, can be challenging. If you have a teenage boy, please don't give him a hug and a kiss when you drop him off at school, at middle school. Don't do that. It's like, Mom. But don't get it. Don't be mistaken in believing that it doesn't matter to him. Dads tend to take a step back from their teenage daughters when they start to develop and it gets suddenly there's this awkwardness. Push through it. It matters. It still matters. There are dozens of ways, from a pat on the back to a back scratch to jostling the hair to all kinds of ways to stay physically connected to a child whose primary love language is physical touch. If you don't have the love language of physical touch, if you didn't grow up with that, it's very, very important for you to understand that you need to push past that with your children who have the love language of physical touch. All right, number 2, words of affirmation. Words of affirmation. Remember, I'm going to say it again each time, we all need all elements of the 5 love languages. We just need one a little bit more primary than the others. It's critical for us all to understand that words matter, and words especially matter for those who have the love language of words of affirmation. The Bible is filled with commands and prohibitions about what we do and what we don't do, and what we say and what we don't say. The most poignant scriptures, I believe personally, for you in training in your household have to do with what comes out of our mouths. My family right now, I've listed about 35 proverbs, and I've given the sheet to all of my family members saying, I want you to pick out your top 10, because we're going to compile a critical list of proverbs that are going to be like kind of like our family, because proverbs is all what? It's all wisdom. It's all instruction for daily living. And so many of these have to do with what we say. Proverbs 12:18, reckless words pierce like a sword, but the tongue of the wise brings healing. Such a powerful scripture. When your kids are fighting with each other, this is a great one. Pull it out. Ready to go. Reckless words. You have just pierced your sister's heart with your mouth like a sword. We don't do that in our house. We don't do that in our house. James chapter 4. I'm sorry, Ephesians chapter 4. Do not let any unwholesome talk come out of your mouths, but only what is helpful for building others up according to the needs of the moment, that it may benefit those who listen. Now, one of the primary ways we show words of affirmation is to say, I love you, which is a good place to start. It's a bad place to finish. I love you is very ethereal. It's very kind of like, okay, like, how do I know that? What does that mean? Words of affirmation that have more to do with character, behavior, accomplishments, these are the things that should be coming from your mouth as it relates to affirming children. Wow, it really took courage when you did that. I was really blessed to see you do that. Thank you so much for thinking in advance to take care of that. I'm blessed that you handled that well. You showed lots of maturity in that situation. You are a great leader. One of the ways, again, one of the pieces of assessing what love languages your children have has to do with what they do, right? So if your child is hanging all over you, well, yeah, I kind of have an inclination that they like physical touch. What comes out of their mouth, what they seek, what they do is reflective of themselves. How do you know your parents love you? Well, because they tell me. Words of affirmation. Words of affirmation. Natalie, my 16-year-old, she's convinced she has physical touch as her primary love language. She's totally wrong. She has no idea. And I'm like, Adam, Natalie, worlds apart. There's no comparison. What is Natalie's primary love language? Words of affirmation. You say, how do you know that? Because she's constantly asking for it. Now, she doesn't know that she's asking for it, and I've never told her. But she's just constantly saying, Dad, how did I do? How did I do on that? Did I do good on that? Whether it's after volleyball, whether it's a school assignment, whatever it happens to be, she's asking for me to affirm her. Pay attention. Notice what your kids are saying and doing as it relates to these five things, and you will see this come to life. When I asked my children, when Adam was in sixth grade and Natalie was in eighth grade, I asked one night at dinner, I said, so, what is the greatest challenge that you face in middle school? Without hesitation, without conferring with one another, simultaneously, they said, cheating. The pressure to cheat, the availability of it, the shame that they get put under when they refuse to do it by other students, it's like off the charts. If you don't have a middle schooler and you're not using, you know, and you're headed toward middle school, public school, buckle up, because it is hands down the most critical issue in the public school system today, middle school and beyond. And it wasn't too long after that that Adam got caught up in cheating. It was just once. He came home and he said, Dad, I got pressured to cheat, and I did on a test. And I said, okay, what do we need to do about that? He already knew the answer to the question. He said, well, I guess we need to go to the school and have a conversation. I said, yes, we do. And I said, so let's talk about what we're going to say when we go meet with the guidance counselor. And we kind of ran through it. I said, what are all the critical elements? What's wrong in this situation? He said, I dishonored God. Right. What's next? I disobeyed you. Yes. I failed to abide by the school structure. Absolutely. Those are the three critical things. We're going to go confess that. And then what are you going to say? You're going to say, whatever needs to happen in your estimation is what needs to happen. So we marched in there. The teacher and the guidance counselor, I don't know what they thought we were coming to do, but they had pulled out everybody. And so Adam looked at the teacher and the guidance counselor, and he said, I just need you to know that I cheated on a test. I disobeyed God. I disobeyed my parents. I broke school policy, and I'm willing to submit to whatever consequences you think are appropriate. All his words. Remember, he was 12 at the time. And the guidance counselor looked at me and looked at the teacher, looked at me and looked at the teacher, looked back at me, and she said, I have no idea what to do. She said, we don't have a policy for this. Like, if they cheat and they get caught, they got plenty of policy for that. But they don't have a policy for kids that confess. She said, in 15 years of public education, I've never had a student confess on their own to cheating. And when I looked at him and I said, do you understand how proud I am of you? Because you took something that was a sinful mistake and you turned it into an experience that this seasoned guidance counselor has never had in her whole life before. I am so proud of you for that. And that is the undergirding kind of interaction that I have with my 14-year-old son, who is one of my favorite people on the planet. Words of affirmation, leveraging those opportunities to speak love into their life. One of the phrases we have in our house is, praise the behavior you want to keep. Praise the behavior you want to keep. You like something, say something. You're liable to see it again. Remember, the kids are specifically sensitive to negative speech. If you aren't a good apologizer for mishandling a situation, you need to be. You need to be. I've gotten real good at that. Will you please forgive me? I'm sorry. I overreacted to that. I said some things that I shouldn't have said. I'm sorry. Will you forgive me? You know, and in 16 years, they've forgiven me every time, so that's good. Also understand that words of affirmation has what's referred to as dialects, meaning you can affirm different things depending on your child. I affirm my wife about things that matter to her, like her appearance and her character. My wife affirms things in me like my performance and my character. If she tells me how great I look in something, I'm like, great, okay. But that's not what scratches the itch for me, right? What scratches the itch for me is that I did well in something. Why? Because males are uniquely, in my opinion, we can have a longer discussion about this at another time, are more uniquely wired in our to performance. We can trace that all the way back to the garden. And when she affirms that, it's helpful to me. All right, we need to move on. We are definitely going to run out of time. All right, so the third one is quality time. The quality time. It's very fascinating that when Jesus called his disciples to be together, the first thing he did with them was that not appointed them to a task, but appointed them to a relationship. It says in Mark 3:14, it says he appointed 12 that they might be with him and that he might send them out to preach. The first thing that he did is he called them to be with him. That's all he did. They spent time together. The first task among the disciples was not a task at all. It was a relationship. You know, I learned early on in my marriage that quality time for my wife meant that I had to make some significant changes in the way I did things because time is her measure, it's not my measure. When we go out to a restaurant, I sit with my back. We specifically position ourselves in the restaurant so that much of the restaurant is to my back. So she has my undivided attention. Because that's gone wrong in the past. She hates errands. She hates going to multiple stores looking for the same item because time matters to her. It's not my measure. I'm fine with that. She's more likely to carry more bags from the car to the house than it's what's really good for her. Why? Because time matters to her, not so much for me. You kind of seeing where this is going, right? I want things done well. She wants things done now. Okay? She's more likely to compromise on quality for the sake of time. I'm more likely to compromise on time for the sake of quality. She always gives me lead time on decisions because I take time to think about them. It's snowing. It's December. What do you think we ought to do for vacation this summer? I'm like, what? Like, you want me to think about something that's 6 months away? Yes, I do. Yes, I do. With your children, there's no such thing as a tension between quality time and quantity time. Quality time happens in the context of quantity time. A child who has quality time might say, I know my parents love me because they spend time with me. I know my parents love me because they come to my sports. Quiet time alone reading for a quality time child may feel like a punishment. Training them to have a quiet time alone will take time. It's okay to have your quiet time with them. A quality time child often will evidence the reality that negative attention is better than no attention. You have a child who's constantly seeking negative attention, they may be just begging for your attention all the way around. For quality time kids, guidelines, ask a lot of questions. Make eye contact. Share stories. Share your story. They want to know how your day was when they get home from school or whatever it might be. Do chores with them. Chores alone is a death sentence. Chores with you is a joy. Watch shows with them. Spend time with them. Number four, gifts. Gifts. Now, it's very important that you understand the essence of this love language. Gifts gets kind of a bad rap of being kind of like the carnal love language. It's like so materialistic, you know, it's like you want stuff. But the reality is that stuff is merely a representation of your love, right? So it doesn't have to cost anything, right? This is the kind of kid that gathers stuff. That they have still have rocks from the last little walk that you took, right? How do I know that your dad loves you? They're going to take you to their room and show you all the stuff that they have from all the trips that his travel, the little trinkets and things that he's brought back that may have cost next to nothing at all. It isn't really about that for them. It's that this thing represents love to them. So don't get mad at your kid for being a bit of a hoarder with stuff, right? Just make collection boxes for it, for their closet. All this, okay, let's gather all of this stuff and make room for the next set of stuff and put it in this kind of keepsake box, which is really just a shoebox from the last time you bought them shoes. James 1 says, every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of heavenly lights, who does not change like shifting shadows. Matthew 7, which of you, if your son asks for bread, will give him a stone, or if he asks for a fish, will give him a snake? If you then, though you are evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father in heaven give good gifts to those who ask him? God is a God of gifts. He's a good giver. And we pattern ourselves after giving gifts like God gives gifts. The word for gift in the Greek is related to the Greek word charis, which you all know means grace. We grace our children. It isn't a reward. Now remember this, gifts aren't rewards. Gifts that are rewards for behavior is payment. It's not the same thing. It's okay to give your kids, you know, some sort of an allowance, it's for chores, or it's okay to give your gifts, you know, a little cash for good grades, or whatever you do in your house. That isn't what we're talking about. Natalie is all about her resources. She started babysitting when she was 13. She pursued it. She got her Red Cross certification as a 13-year-old. And I have parents who were parents that had 18-year-olds coming to babysit their children and said, no, I'd rather have your daughter. I know she's only 13, but she's much more attentive to my kids than the 17-year-old that usually comes to my house. And she has a bank account now that is loaded as a 16-year-old, right? But it's she doesn't. She's not a person of gifts. She just wants to be paid. Right? And so it's not the same thing. It's not the same thing. Not all gifts have to be bought. Rocks, wildflowers, all count. As they get older, make sure as a guideline that you give them stuff that they like. Hello, don't give them stuff they don't like. Doesn't matter to them. For gifts with primary love language, for kids with primary love languages, gifts, wrap it. They love wrapping. Wrap it, whatever it is, it doesn't matter. And then give them your undivided attention when they're opening it. Select gifts from their area of interest, not yours. Personalized gifts are winners, something with their name on it. Hide gifts in their lunchbox. Find unique ways to give them gifts. All right, last love language. We're going to make it. Acts of service. Again, found in the scriptures everywhere. Mark chapter 10, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Jesus is the consummate lover. He is the consummate servant. John 13, Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power and that he had come from God and was returning to God. So he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, wrapped a towel around his waist. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with a towel, the towel that was wrapped around his waist. Acts of service. This is my primary love language. For people to do something kind for me is very, very powerful. The goal isn't to make someone with the primary love language of service happy. It's to fill their love tank. You know, Adam, I think he ranks rather high in acts of service. My daughter, not so much. When you serve her, she doesn't necessarily appreciate it so much because that's what all of her subjects are supposed to do. You with me? Some of you have kids like that. So how you serve matters. Now, I will tell you, on a night when she's been up till 1 a.m. studying, because as a high school sophomore, it's crazy the amount of work that she has, and that she's getting up the next day to race off to school to do Fellowship of Christian Athletes, and I make her bed for her, that's truly an act of service for her. So, some guidelines. Help when they are uncertain. Help when they are uncertain. If your child is required to make their bed, but they really don't know how to do it yet, you're moving in a direction, that is an act of service. When you make your child's bed for them, when they should be able to make the bed themselves, that is not an act of service. That is rescuing them from your structure in your house. Don't do that. Don't do that. Don't do for them what they can do for themselves, unless, like making Natalie's bed when she's in a time crunch, it fits. Service is not a gift, not an obligation, and it's not a reward. A child with this love language will often ask for help with tasks. Often. It's a discerning element in understanding how they're wired. Natalie had AP World History, and it was about to put her under, literally. And I read a section of her textbook, and I'm like, this is college-level reading. This is college-level reading. So we spent the semester, she had to do all these reading guides where she had to read it and then summarize in response to these questions. And we spent the whole semester, I was photocopying all the pages of her book. I was reading them first, highlighting critical phrases, and then talking through with her every assignment that she had. I was probably spending 10 hours a week with her doing AP World History. And it was the most powerful thing for our relationship in years, that I served her that way and we worked together on it. And I didn't just say, go study history. I knew she wasn't going to get it done. It was beyond her. And we made better decisions the following year on what classes she should take. We could go on and on. Let me wrap up by a couple of more points of discernment about how to discern some of these things. So a reminder, first of all, is that you will grow in your understanding, but your children are going to grow also. If you have young children, how they are wired in this whole discussion is still probably very difficult for you to discern. It takes time. And that's why you should practice. You should ask them questions. Would you rather have me help you with this, or would you rather go to the store and get that? Right? Do they want a gift? What is a gift? You need to get them shoes anyway, and you want this accomplished. So doing something together, quality time, versus going out and getting something, give them options that will help you discern the way in which they are wired. I would discourage you from actually having conversations with your children about love languages, because they're going to tell you what they think they would like, and it's going to skew the whole situation, right? You want to kind of assess and discern apart from their assessment, because they may or may not be effective. They see you doing something with one of your other children, and they want that, but that may not be what's most effective for them. Love languages do tend to morph over time. My wife's love language was quality time, but you know what? Acts of service kind of became a little bit more important when she had two in diapers at the same time. So again, some of those examples. Do you want to snuggle? Do you want to draw a picture? Do you want to go to the store for some shoes? Do you want to put a puzzle together? All right. I think we have time for about two questions, and then I'm going to send you into your discussion questions. There's so much more we could say. There's so much more in the book that we haven't had a chance to cover today, such as children and education and some other kind of issues in the book if you've looked at it. But questions before we send you into your table conversations. Yes?
Do you think that the way your children and your spouse gives love language is often the way they receive, or can those sometimes be different?
I'm sorry, say that one more time?
So the way that we give love language, does that always reflect the way that we receive it?
Almost always, yes. Yes. Yeah, because it makes sense to us, right? So when I'm loving someone, who wouldn't want that, right? Because that's what I prefer. So almost always, yes. Anybody else? Wow, I must have done an excellent job. All right. Yes?
What age do you think you can kind of gauge where they have a primary?
Yeah. Yeah, I think by the age of 5, it's probably starting to emerge, because now they're verbal. Now they have more engagement with the world around them. They've been to the store with you. They've been, they're engaged in education. They, whatever. You're starting to make requirements of them, right, to do certain things on their own. So now they're starting to ask for things. So I think by the age of 5, you should be able to begin discerning. But again, I will tell you, it is challenging. My wife and I had a lot of conversations I was preparing some of this for another teaching last year, and we had some conversations about our kids going, well, what do you think? Some of it was really obvious, and some of it wasn't so much, and then we started to have to kind of talk about some of the ways our kids interact with us, and it started to become clear, but it took a little bit of time. Anybody else? Yes, ma'am.
that yeah. it feels like a real tension between really wanting to continue to
correct
your child as well as
that structure. Right. Yeah, that's a great question. We'd have to talk a little bit in greater detail and get some kind of specifics. But one of the things I would say is I would caution against mechanisms for discipline that are directly tied to their love language because you don't want it to feel like deprivation. Does that make sense? So for a child whose love language is quality time, sending them to their room is that's a classic one. Like that's an easy one to consider. That is potentially produces greater negative outcome than if you discipline through other forms of structure. I would rather, if my child's love language is quality time, I would rather discipline them by doing something with them. Right? So I would have them do something that they don't want to do as a discipline, but do it with them. Then go make them do it alone. As they're grumbling the whole time, they're doing it. Right? So again, discerning the love language and saying, and then discerning your discipline mechanism and trying not to penalize them in a way that could cause them to feel less loved, shall we say? Because now you're fighting against yourself. Does that make sense? That's a really important thing, by the way. All right. Yes, one last. Yeah, I think that the value of love languages is that the moments of speaking love are poignant, right? That it's not like oh here. You know what I'm saying? And I think I guess I'm struggling to picture what you're saying, to actually picture how that plays out. If it's selfishness, I guess, how old is your...
He's 5, almost 6.
Okay.
And if he comes, to expect the gifts. Like, well, where's mine? And why is his bigger?
Yeah, and you feel convinced that gifts is a love language. It's not just selfishness.
You know, he's a collector. Like
yeah. Five, sure. Yeah, right. Yeah, I think that every child needs to understand, let's just say my child has quality time for a love language, but my other kids need my time too, right? So everybody experiences a little bit of they don't get their love language spoken every minute of the day. And so to draw some boundaries around, when you see selfishness grow out of that the expression of love isn't appreciated, I would point that out. You know, as I would point it out to my child who has quality time, I would say, you know what, I love you and I spend a lot of time with you because I know that that matters to you, but your brother needs my time too, and so you need to understand that you can't have all of my time, but I do, and I understand that you love collecting things and you love gifts, but I feel like this time it's turning into something that's a little bit selfish. And sometimes the fact that you love gifts means that we need to give gifts to others too. So I would shape his perspective on understanding the receiving and the giving of gifts in the context of their love language and the sin nature combined. Does that make sense? All right. Back to you. All right, so on your table, ladies, you should have your discussion questions. I appreciate the opportunity to have been with you today, and God bless.